Okay, everyone. We are on paper 118, section 5, which is old single column, page 1299. Okay, well, we're just plugging along again. They back off on the intensity just a little bit here now from what we had in the previous section. But you'll notice that even, you know, when they're not giving you even more, they're expecting you to really be utilizing what you've learned. So they're very demanding in their, you know, in their construct of the book. So you want to always be looking for greater understanding by bringing into play all of the this incredible amount of effort that we've put into trying to put the pieces together, and we want to make sure that's not all for naught. Let's make sure we put it to good use. Okay, so you can see that the next two sections here obviously have a common theme in the first word of their titles. So this first one, omnipotence and compossibility. Compossibility, you know, it's a fancy sounding word, but it's not that complicated. I mean, all you really have to, you know, remember is what that prefix com, you know, is usually indicating. You know, it means with. You know, so what the title means is all powerfulness, you know, omnipotence, all powerfulness, and conformity with possibility. You know, that whole issue of okay, so you have all the power at your disposal. Does anything go, including magic? And the answer is, of course, no. You can only do what's in conformity with possibility. So they start us out here with a little single paragraph exploration of that issue. So let's jump into that and see where they take us.
5. Omnipotence and compossibility. The omnipotence of deity does not imply the power to do the non-doable. Within the time-space frame and from the intellectual reference point of mortal comprehension, even the infinite God cannot create square circles or produce evil that is inherently good. God cannot do the ungodlike thing. Such a contradiction of philosophic terms is the equivalent of non-entity and implies that nothing is thus created. A personality trait cannot at the same time be godlike and ungodlike. Compossibility is innate in divine power, and all of this is derived from the fact that omnipotence not only creates things with a nature, but also gives origin to the nature of all things and beings.
Okay, so you see they put a big paragraph break there. They start you out with this very precise little discussion of this issue. So let's dig into it just a little bit. I mean, the basics is obvious. What they're pointing out here is what we've brought up time and time and time again. I mean, one of the key things that the revelation is trying to get mankind to assume, since he's had a hard time discovering it, despite all the gifts that we're given that allow you to discover this, the universe is inherently logical. Period. You know, absolutely no magic. You know, we're talking infinity, so it can get very complicated. But just because it's very complicated or very far removed from our immediate experiences or whatnot, doesn't mean it's ever magical. It's always logical. It has to be. There's one first source and center of all things and beings, creator of all things and beings. That's what makes it all synchronized together in absolute logical structure. This last little sentence is giving you a little sort of test way to think about that basic issue. We often invoke the square circles when we're pointing out compossibility. So, just think about that simple little example in the light of this last sentence. Because it's obviously they want you to really focus there. And all of this is derived from the fact that omnipotence not only creates things with a nature, but also gives origin to the nature of all things and beings. So take that first part, things with a nature. Okay, so I have a circle. There's a thing. Now, I could imagine, what if this circle, this thing that I have, has non-circular characteristics, has a non-circular nature? What if I imagined a circle with a non-circular nature? Ooh, wow, that sounds cool. Imagine what that would imply. Wow, that's like really mystical and magical and really cool. I can write a whole book on that and sell millions of copies because people love thinking about mysticism. Circles with a non-circular nature, just imagine it. Okay? Now, you don't, at that point, you can't say, well, you can't do that. Yes, you can. People have been doing it for a million years. Okay? This is one of mankind's favorite games. People devote their whole lives to such things. Okay? Take the rest of the thing. Turn it around. Look at it the other direction. Because the thing and its nature are not separate. They're inseparable. Why? Because there's one first source and center of all things and all beings. They come together. Think about non-circular nature. Okay? If I have non-circular nature, what can I do with that? Well, I can, that's non-circular nature is the nature of non-circular things. Circular nature is the nature of circular things. And that's what circular means. The two go together. Yes, you can imagine starting with the thing and giving it, a circle and giving it a non-circular nature. But you can't do that because the two are connected. You have to be able to think about it both directions. Okay? It has to be logical. Okay? Not just rationalizable, because it's rationalizable in just one direction. Believe me, especially if you're really smart and very motivated, you'll write a 5,000-page tome on the magnificent consequences, the complete lifestyle solution of non-circular circles. There's lots and lots of examples. Let's just focus on one little example here that we have invoked a number of times. Just that specific of the square circles, So the notion of I have a circle with a square nature.
Sorry.
I have a circle with a square nature. Okay, that's, and it's like, well, no one would ever
No one would ever run with that notion. Oh, yes, they do. Yeah?
On the computer AutoCAD, there's like 241 or 44 lines that make up a circle.
Right. But that's, you know, not an actual circle. You know, that's an approximation of a circle. Okay? A circle's a circle. Okay? It's not a bunch of line segments stuck together. It's one line closed. Okay? So a circle with a square nature. You know, has anyone, you know, ever, you know, had the audacity to base a whole theory on such a notion? Yeah, let's take a simple example that all of you have heard about. You know, none of you have a PhD in physics, but everyone has heard about this somewhere. What if we imagined that we had a particle that had a wave nature? Ooh, man, that would be really cool. That's got possibilities. And has there been a book written on it? Yeah, there's been a countless number of books written on it, a countless number of articles written on it. Thousands of people have devoted their entire lives to filling books full of massive amounts of super complex mathematics about particles with a wave nature. Okay. No. Wave nature is related to wave things. Waves. Okay? Okay. It's illogical to have a particle with a wave nature, just like it's illogical to have a circle with a square nature. Okay? There is no such thing. Okay? And it doesn't matter, you know, the decades now of the brightest minds that have lived in the last 100 years have devoted their lives to that notion. There is no such thing. Okay? Or let's take another example. You know, go back up and look at the other nice little logical statement they have in there. Such a contradiction of philosophic terms is the equivalent of non-entity and implies that nothing is thus created. What's a simple example of something like that? I develop a very beautiful mathematical theory of gravity called general relativity. It's a nice little beautiful set of equations. And I start playing with those equations to see, you know, because these equations are describing the processes involving mass and gravity and how things might evolve under certain circumstances, like, say, for instance, if a star was dying and it was collapsing under its own gravitational weight, what does this theory tell us happens? You know, what's created through that process of this collapsing object? You know, the theory is supposed to, you know, claims to tell us what gets created. Well, you grind through the theory, and the theory says that you create a finite thing. You know, I mean, a star is really big, it's got a lot of mass and whatnot, but it's still finite. You create, you know, when all is said and done, the star becomes a finite thing with an infinite property. Yeah. Such a contradiction of philosophic terms, a finite thing with an infinite property, okay, is the equivalent of non-entity and implies that nothing is thus created.
Okay?
Right? There are no black holes. Okay? Just because you can go forward with something, you know that nothing is thus, you know, as the theory says, is thus created, because it's a contradiction of philosophic terms. It's a finite thing with an infinite property. Okay? You can't have something that has a finite mass, and finite everything else that you might talk about, in an infinite density. Okay? You know, why does it have an infinite density? Because it has zero volume. Okay? Non-zero mass and zero volume. You know, the singularity at the center of the black hole. Okay? It's equivalent to non-entity. There is no such entity. Okay? Okay? So in both of those cases, this is why so-called science is just that, so-called science. It is not regulated by logic anymore. Okay? You start with the notion of a circle, and then you imagine that it has square properties, and you go, wow, that is really mystical and cool, and you run with it. That's what they do now. Okay? And it only took them a few decades, and someone noticed, you know, wow, this quantum theory that we have is just like Eastern mysticism. And they started writing books about how the two were the same. And of course, Eastern mysticism has been around for a very, very long time. Quantum mechanics is a brand new theory. So therefore, quantum mechanics is validated by the antiquity of the theory that it's in complete parallel with. Okay? And on it goes. Okay? It's basically all, you know, religion has always been prone to this problem of being delighted by creating a mystical circumstance like this, a thing with anti that kind of thing properties, you know, and imagining it. Science 2,500 years ago was an attempt to break out of that, at least in regard to physical issues. No one knew how to approach spiritual issues that way, but at least they were going to try in the physical domain to break out of that mode. Now look where we are again. Okay, why do we need the fifth epical revelation? Because the one thing that was trying to get us in this direction of bringing compossibility into our thinking has evaporated. Okay, we're just falling back into a primitive state of mind. You know, advanced technology, you know, held by primitive beings. Obviously not primitive technologically, but primitive in a cosmic sense, in a true sense. You know, and that's what's important. The cosmos is interested in us not being primitive in a cosmic sense, which means you need to start with your cosmic foundation. You need to have a logical acumen and a moral discrimination and a spiritual insight. Okay? You know, and that first cosmic intuition, okay, that's what we're talking about here. The first cosmic intuition is what allows you to think about that last sentence and go, yeah, I'm getting a reality response with that sentence. What's the word for it? Yeah, logical. That's what it is. Logical acumen. Yeah. You're given the ability to just know that. Okay? You know, the revelators don't have a whole paper devoted to trying to prove that sentence to you. They just state it. He who has ears to hear, particular this one, you know, let him hear. You know, that's what they do all the time. They're trying to make an appeal to a starting point. If they can't get you to awaken your relationship to the three cosmic intuitions, there's nothing, okay, that they can do. And so, all throughout the book, you know, you go through all the religion papers over and over and over again. In those religion papers, they appeal to the three cosmic intuitions. You know, they say something like, now, do you get a reality response to that? Is that not just logical? Does that not sound like the proper starting point, a better initial assumption, because it's true? This, you know, just recognize that you don't have to know anything about the equations of general relativity. You don't have to be analytical to be logical. It has nothing to do with that, really. Okay? All you have to know is someone who is analytical approaches you and says, ooh, look at this really cool thing I've got. You know, and they start drawing all kinds of Greek letters and whatnot, and you're going, ooh, they must know what they're talking about. It's got superscripts and subscripts, and, you know, and it's all complicated. And then you get them to explain, well, okay, what does it tell you? What does all this really complicated mathematics tell you? And they say, well, we've discovered that there's finite things with an infinite property. And you go, no, you haven't. Okay? And they say, well, who are you to say you aren't a PhD in, you know, in astrophysics? It's like, well, I don't have to be. That's illogical. Six-year-olds know that. Why don't you? And, you know, he said, well, okay, so I wonder what else they're going to talk about in this section. I mean, I hope they start talking about something that's a little bit more related to me and to God, because I'm really anxious to kind of understand that a little more. Well, you know, that's what they do. But think about what they did first. Before they talked about you and your relationship with God, they gave you this paragraph challenging you to awaken your logical acumen. Why? Because now they're going to appeal to your spiritual insight, you know, the fact that you know that there's a God and that you're a child of God, and they want you to connect the two. They want you to have both eyes open when you think about God. You know, so that when you think about God, God is logical. Because after all, that's why there's logic, is because there's a God. It goes both ways. God implies logic, and logic implies God.
I wonder if it's one of his attributes.
Right. Right. You know, I am, remember when we went through total deity, you know, we started with the infinite. We had one thing, and the very next step was creating the triune facets of the deity that I am. And what were they? I am that which acts. I am that which reacts. I am that which results. In other words, everything is logical. It's causal. Action, reaction, result. Causal. Okay? There's nothing left out of those three. That encompasses everything. The universe is totally logical. Okay. So let's read both of these two paragraphs together.
Spock almost saved the day.
Put these two together, and then we'll go back and notice some details in them a little bit.
In the beginning, the Father does all, but as the panorama of eternity unfolds in response to the will and mandates of the infinite, it becomes increasingly apparent that creatures, even men, are to become God's partners in the realization of finality of destiny. And this is true even in the life in the flesh. When man and God enter into partnership, no limitation can be placed upon the future possibilities of such a partnership. When man realizes that the Universal Father is his partner in eternal progression, when he fuses with indwelling Father presence, he has, in spirit, broken the fetters of time and has already entered into upon the progressions of eternity in the quest for the Universal Father. Mortal consciousness proceeds from the fact to the meaning and then to the value. Creator consciousness proceeds from the thought value through the word meaning to the fact of action. Always must God act to break the deadlock of the unqualified unity inherent in existential infinity. Always must deity provide the pattern universe, the perfect personalities, the original truth, beauty, and goodness for which all sub-deity creations strive. Always must God first find man, that man may later find God. Always must there be a universal Father before there can ever be universal sonship and consequent universal brotherhood.
Okay. Before we really put those two paragraphs in the context of this section, let's just notice a couple little asides in here. That last little statement, always must there be a universal Father before there can ever be universal sonship and consequent universal brotherhood. Okay. So, God the Father is the initiator. Right? He initiates sons. God the Father initiates sons. And then when he has initiated sons, then God the Mother can focalize them into a brotherhood. Okay? Just notice in passing, you know, if you have both of the, you know, both of those actions in mind, if you're always looking for initiator focalizer, if you're looking for the initiation and the focalization going on in a particular situation, you know, you're looking for what hand did God the Father have in this circumstance and what hand did God the Mother have in this circumstance. Yeah. So in regard to sons, Father is the initiator and God the Mother is the focalizer. You know, and the consequent, like we've talked about, that, you know, you connect it through the individuality of the whole. If you're a person, you know, that's what we're talking about, the Father making you a person, and then consequently, you know, you're connected through the Mother. Okay, so just notice that one little thing. Another nice little precise point up in the towards the end of the previous paragraph. Did it kind of catch you a little bit there when it said, when man realizes that the universal Father is his partner in eternal progression, and you go, okay, I think I know what they're talking about here. When he fuses with the indwelling Father presence, you're going, well, wait a minute, I wasn't going that far. I wasn't thinking all the way to fusion. I was just thinking, you know, I realize that, you know, that I'm a child of God. No. You don't realize. You recognize that you're a child of God. Okay? Remember, it's recognition, and then the next level up is realization. Yeah. We mentioned this. Challenge yourself to stop blurring those two words together, like, you know, common parlance always does. See, they mean it literally. Okay? You know, when man realizes this, when he takes that recognition and moves all the way up the psychic circles because of that recognition and gets to the point of fusion and then realizes this. In other words, when you apply your spirit pattern, your purposing to the adjuster, when you personalize the adjuster, when you realize the adjuster, okay, that's why it says that way. You know, they're seeing if you're thinking. By purposely putting it like that, and see if you get a disconnect. You know, is there a cognitive dissonance there? It's like, wait a minute, I don't understand that. Isn't that like talking about the two endpoints and they're equating them? No. Just recognition, and then a lot of work, you know, a whole lot of work moving up in relationship to the levels of the cosmic levels, the levels that the Mother establishes, a whole lot of mother-like work, and finally you get to diffusion. Starts with recognition. Father gave you that ability to recognize. Mother did too, a little bit of initial encirclement there. Yeah. And then you've got to choose your way up. And finally, there's a realization point. Okay. Now, the basic, you know, question, though, is still in play. Why are these two paragraphs in a section entitled, of all things, something where I probably had to look up a word in the title of the section and figure out what the heck it meant, okay? Omnipotence and compossibility. What does that have to do with this stuff that I seem to have a basic understanding of? Do you have both eyes open? What is the thing that they're trying to get you to, you know, the compossibility issue that they're trying to get you to recognize there? Okay? God as a creator, again, you're just like a, you know, sevenfold creators coming down from the Father. God as a creator is a top-down phenomenon. You, as a creature, are a bottom-up phenomenon. Okay? You can't do that top-down creator thing. And the creators can't do that bottom-up creature thing. Okay? That is impossible. It is not in conformity with possibility. Okay? They do the top down, you do the bottom up. You need them, they need you. Okay? Without both, there's nothing. The one can't exist without the other. That's compossibility. Okay? To see yourself as that integrated into the picture. You know, it's not that there's just some creators and they're having a grand old time, you know, and they were bored one day and they made some creatures and you're trying to figure out the magical incantation to get in on their game, you know, or something. That's not the universe. Okay? It's perfectly synchronized and totally dependent, interdependent. Okay? They can't do bottom up. You can't do top down. That's why, you know, you need each other. Think about the way that first of these two paragraphs started, you know, along those lines. In the beginning, the Father does all. What, you know, what are they talking about there? I mean, if I just said that if there's a downward, there has to be an upward. Well, if in the beginning the Father does all, well, then by definition there can't be a downward. Oh, yeah, that's right. It doesn't start, there isn't downward and upward initially. Initially, I have to create the absolute level. It's not up or down, it's horizontal. Initially, the Father does all. You know, and we've talked about that for years, you know, thinking about the seven absolutes of infinity, you know, fleshing out, you know, at least, you know, the main points that we can actually recognize in that absolute level. It's horizontal. Okay? But once that's established, you know, and the moment that there's something besides that horizontal action, you know, and it, you know, can go up. It's at the top. The only thing it can do, besides, I mean, once it fills out the totality of the horizontal, is to go down. The instant that there's any downward, there's an upward. Yeah. The two are inseparable.
When so when he mentioned that it makes my mind think of the, you know, the, I always have kind of a confusion of the I am. Okay, so if I'm figuring, like I'm thinking about God, and he's this I am, so this energy.
Well, before there was a God, there was an I am.
Yeah, so it's this I am. Okay, yeah. So he's going to be, he's everything. It's not even a he, it's just this presence.
Right, it's just the concept of everything.
Right, and so for some reason, he's not satisfied, or this thing is not satisfied.
What's missing?
Relationships.
Right.
Okay.
Right, there's, it's singular.
Right, so
there's one, only one name is required to describe everything. I am. So there's no relationship.
So he just wants to be I.
He doesn't want to be, you know, think about it logically. It's not a desire, it's a logical necessity. Okay? You started out and you said, okay, I'm going to imagine everything and I'm going to call it I am. And then the little kid in the class raises his hand and says, well, I don't think you've imagined everything there, because I can imagine something that's not there. I could imagine two and the relationship between the two. Oh, you're right. And if this is everything, that's got to be there too, doesn't it? Oh, well, how do I fit that in? See, if you're going to assume it's everything, one of the things amongst all of everything is relationship. And just that, if you start with the concept of simply the I am, it's singular. And it obviously isn't everything. But it doesn't mean that you throw that out and say, well, let me imagine an infinite number of things all flopped in front of me. Oh, that's way too complicated. I don't even know where to start. See, the whole point is you start with the notion of singular, and then you start, you use will to set a process in motion that gets all of the other things that you know have to be there, but you do it in a logical order, one step at a time. Now, in actuality, from a complete top-down view, it's infinity. Everything is already there. Boom. Okay? From our perspective, if you go all around to the all-are point, okay, that's where you have an infinite number of things instead of just one thing in your picture. Okay, that is there. But that's incomprehensible to you and I. But recognizing that it is there is something that we've been challenging ourselves to do a little bit, to try to deal with this antecedent following stuff that we keep running into. You know, if you think about it, that actually everything is really there. And what you're doing is you're starting out with a little tiny sphere of comprehension in this infinite field of fact. And, you know, as your experience grows, as you evolve and eventuate, that your sphere of experience just expands until finally your sphere of experience embraces the infinite all are. Okay? I mean, it's always been there. It's just that you are experientially moving out through it. And so from your perspective, the stuff that's outside of your domain of experience is not there. But it actually is. It's just, you know, it's just everyone, you know, is expanding outward until finally everyone will have, you know, their domain of experience will have embraced the whole picture. And the cool thing is about this beginning to understand what you're experiencing as you're growing. They say, you know, the best way to start understanding what you're experiencing is start with the singular concept of the I am, not with the infinite, you know, all are. Start with the singular I am and follow our suggestions here and start building. And you'll begin to understand, at least, you know, have some way of putting the pieces together as to why you've experienced what you've experienced so far and how you're going to experience things after now and on and on and on, you know. So that's why they suggest it that way. It's a way of getting yourself into the game, but knowing that there's an infinite number of things that you're not including to start with, but that's okay because you don't need an infinite number of things to understand what's going on in your initial little tiny sphere of experience yet. Start with just what you need to figure out that little experiential space, you know, and then as you grow, bring more of the picture into your understanding.
So then the I am, when it begins, the whole universe, nothing is separate yet. Everything is right here.
Right.
And then he decides that he wants a relationship, so he makes himself, he bifurcates, isn't that where that word?
Yeah.
And he decides to become the universal father. So then when he's the universal father, he can make the eternal son. So
when he makes the eternal son, he becomes the universal father.
Makes the eternal son, yeah. Okay, well.
See, the first thing he does is he fleshes out that absolute level. He creates all the relationship on the absolute level. And so there's no vertical, you know. He needs all of the possible absolute relationships. Boom, 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 you know. Of course, in the process of creating all these other absolute facts, you know, not all beings, like the aisle, you know, and other stuff is there too. Okay, you create all that. You bring what is really most directly an absolute fact. The universal father, just as the universal father, is like the eternal son. That's an absolute fact. That's not really an infinite fact. It has roots in an infinite fact. But just in and of itself, you know, he's the volitional absolute, not the volitional infinite. He's the volitional absolute. Okay? So, see, in the process, initially you can kind of think of the first thing you do is you take the infinity and you pull all the absolute chunks out of it, and now you have a whole bunch of names like Universal Father and Eternal Son and, you know, Unqualified Absolute and whatnot, okay? But then there's all the other stuff that you haven't pulled out yet. But to pull that out, you've got to do something besides go horizontally because it's sub-absolute, all the other stuff. And so then you start getting this, you know, bi-directional system set up where you're drawing stuff out of the potentials and reaching down to engage what you're drawing up.
Is that when he creates all the planets? And
that's when the first thing is what they mentioned here. Let's see, where was that? Always must God act to break the deadlock of the unqualified unity inherent in existential infinity. Always must deity provide the pattern universe, the perfect personalities, the original truth, beauty, and goodness. Okay, the first thing is not the four outer space levels and the seven super universes and all that. You know, what's the first thing? The first thing is the pattern universe, Havona. Okay, and the perfect personalities, Havona natives. Okay, but that's, you know, a sub-absolute place and sub-absolute beings, even though they're perfect. So that's the first thing. Okay. And there's a whole process which happened before what you and I recognize as time. There's a whole process that went on in Havona to let that fully flesh out to the extent that it can without, going farther down away from the absolute. Havona is becoming more than it was because of us, now. But before us, you had the bestowal of the Eternal Son and the Infinite Spirit in Havona, and the bestowal of the original Michael Son in Havona, and all the stuff about sort of, rattling all around, getting all the relationship and whatnot brought into existence that you can do just without a starting point. And then once that was done, once you had that all fleshed out, then boom, instantly more comes into existence. And as soon as we have this all fleshed out in the grand universe, as soon as we've rattled it around inside this can, long enough that every single thing that you can get out of this, when this is all there is, central universe and this, once we've completed everything we can do, boom, then there's going to be more. Okay? Not only can you do that new stuff, but the old stuff can do stuff it couldn't do before because now it has a relationship with this stuff that it didn't have before. And on and on and on and on it goes. All right, so that's... Oh, you got a question?
I find it interesting that it starts out, that sentence you just quoted, always must God act to break the deadlock. It's almost the why I thought of the way that the master architects came into being and they tried to do one more and it reached the limit and it got absorbed back in right away.
Right.
It's almost like God has to, so he has to act, that's how he has to act.
Yeah, I mean, and that's...
To break the deadlock.
Well, that specific example is hearkening back to the deadlock. See, it starts out, everything is in closed loops. It's all self hyphen something or other, self something or other. Everything is in this closed loop. Okay, and self-willed, needs to step into this situation and open up one of those circuits. Allow something besides just going around and around in and of itself.
Right, self-will.
Okay, and so you do something like you start rolling out the architects.
Yeah.
Okay, and what you find is, it rolls out and rolls out and rolls out until it gets to the point where you try to roll out something else and it rolls back on itself again. So you've filled out everything from some bottom, all the way up, up to that boundary where anything beyond that is right back where you started again. It's wrapping back on itself. You've unrolled everything that can unroll. And what's left behind is what has to stay, self-contained, self-existent, self-whatever, self-willed, self-personalized, all those, you're trying to not everything has to go around and around. And so what doesn't have to go round and round, you let roll out.
But that's almost like us. A lot of times we'll get stymied. We'll just be, this circular thing in our heads,
Ask God.
Until we break that deadlock and say, you know what, I've had enough of this, I'm going to act.
Right. And what are those, what is that possibility called? Something came down to break that deadlock. Both the father and the mother came down to break that deadlock. They gave you a personality, the father did, and the mother gave you the Holy Spirit, the three cosmic intuitions. That's how you break the deadlock. Yourself, in and of itself, your simple little adjutant, mindless self, okay, is just like that stuff we're contemplating back at the beginning. Okay, all it can do is chase its tail. That's all it will ever do. And it doesn't matter how fancy you do it or how much you imagine it's cool or whatever and write books about it. Okay, it's just a self going round and around and around. God has given you what you need to break that. Okay.
The personality
and the three intuitions. Okay. The personality, is what can reach in and grab a hold of it. Okay, but you need something besides just grabbing hold of it. You need some place to take it to. You know, if it's locked in a little bubble that's just going around and around, I mean, if I grab a hold of it and there's no doorway out of the bubbles, so what? And now the personality is just going to be going around and around with it. Okay, there needs to be a doorway, some outlet to take that circle and string it out as an ascending line. That's the three cosmic intuitions. They're the doorway to the cosmos. Your personality can take all of that motion that's locked in the self and let it flow up in relationship to the cosmos.
And the personality gets the initiative to do that when it gets some degree of spirit insight, probably.
Right. I mean, yeah. Right. Yeah. You're given an initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit so that, you can get it started.
Right.
See? So there can be an initial recognition. Yeah. But then once you recognize there's this, the cosmos is open to you, mm-hmm. and that's the answer that you've been looking for, well, now be about the Father's business and with the Mother's gift.
Chris?
Okay.
doesn't it break the chain of human fear?
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked about, when we look at it in the hourglass, where the gateway is the neck of the hourglass there. What's the foundation of that bottom, region of the hourglass? That's where you're rattling around is just nothing but self. That's the level of fear, zeroth level of meaning. That whole circular thing. See, that's actually what drives most of that motion.
Fear.
Is fear. Because that's the foundation of it. You get close to it, and you start scurrying up away from it, but unfortunately you wrap right back, and that just is what keeps it going around and around. That's why the first religions are, religions of fear. That's the only thing it can be.
Otherwise we wouldn't do anything. We'd just stay in stasis.
Eventually you get a little bit, mature enough where you go, well, there's something besides that prod that I felt at the bottom. There's also this state up the top where I got all kinds of cool thoughts going on and stuff, before I get fearful again. I could create a religion of the mind, based upon the stuff that's in the upper part of the loop, But of course, it comes back, And so what we have, we don't have pure religions of the mind and pure religions of fear. We have a combination of the two because the circle, is down at the bottom, and then it's up at the top, and it's down at the bottom, I am by nature and sinful and unclean, and, then I've got the whole rationalization scheme of Jesus died for my sins, and then I'm by nature and sinful and unclean, and see, around and around you go, okay? Yeah. I mean, if there wasn't fear down at the bottom level, you'd just be laying there, supine, with your mouth open, waiting for the dates to fall, off the palm tree into your mouth. Everyone would just be laying there in the bottom, if it wasn't prickly, okay? So God purposely made it prickly, so you didn't want to lay down there, okay? You would at least for a moment run up to the mountaintop, and he's hoping that one time around, you'll look up when you're up there. Because when you're up at the hot top part of the loop, you can actually see that there's an opening there. but if your gaze is fixed downward when you're up at the top, and we've talked, technically, how does this work? There's levels down there, but there's just two, see? So, really, you're rolling around between the level of the flesh and the level of feelings, okay? And that mysticism you're talking about, the one thing that, people have thought about doing, because they haven't thought of going up, because they haven't been looking up when they're up at the top, they've been looking sideways, and they notice that when they're up there, there's this vast level up there, and that level of feelings. And so one of the things that they've done is they've figured out ways that they can hold themselves up at the top for a little while, and spread way out into some really elaborate, bizarre place off horizontally in mind, and get all kinds of really groovy experiences, okay? Yeah, but no matter how far you go, eventually you fall. Yeah. Okay, and then it starts all over again.
It wears off.
Yeah. Okay. So it's just, just if you think about it in our, the system they've given us, it's just trivial to understand how this works. What we've been doing for all these millennia, and why we can do something else.
I mean, we've found a number of things that are trying to encourage people to look up, but self is oh so fascinating, and the experiences, especially that self can have, if it goes playing off, you know, in the hinterlands, we're too self-absorbed. We have all these little tidbits of wisdom, but do we listen to them? No, it's sad to record. It's so few persons. You know, take the light in trying to do something with what you can see when you look up. All right. Okay, so we have omnipotence and compossibility. Now we have omnipotence and omniscience. Another fancy word. But it's the root there is facere that we use all the time, the Latin word to do. So it's all powerfulness and all doingness. Okay, so they're gonna explore that. Just because you're all powerful, does that mean that you do everything? You know, even within the limits of compossibility. You know, so I won't do magical things. I'll just do, you know, everything. The possible. But do I do everything? Me? Is God selfish? You know, within the domains of compossibility?
Yeah. 6, omnipotence and omniscience. God is truly omnipotent, but he is not omniscient. He does not personally do all that is done. Omnipotence embraces the power potential of the Almighty Supreme and the Supreme Being. But the volitional acts of God the Supreme are not the personal doings of God the Infinite.
Okay, now we've got to stop there. Because this is kind of cool. God the Infinite. It's a once phrase. Okay, it's our third one now. You know, in this set of 5 papers. Mm-hmm. First they gave us God the Almighty, only time it occurs in the book. Then they gave us God the Mother, only time it occurs in the book. And now they gave us God the Infinite. Okay? And we've never tried to think with that starting point. Literally something that we were going to call God the Infinite, and then see what we could do from that starting point. Okay? And what you can do is only really possible if you've done what we've done. Okay? If you've taken the time to try to put together some of the pieces of total deity. So instead of starting with the I am, where you're trying to think about not just, you know, God in that mix, but everything else, Havona, worlds and whatnot, ultimatons and microphones and cameras and everything was all balled up in the I am at one time. What if you just start with something that maybe is a little bit more direct? Let's, you know, because you got the God notion. Well, let's start at the top, you know. What am I going to call a God that's completely transcendent at the top of everything? It's called God the Infinite, okay? You know, it can't be anything beyond that. Okay, so let's start there. Let's try that. So in other words, see, you remember when we talked about deity, we talked about the infinite. You know, okay, well, personalize that. Call it God the Infinite. Okay, well, if you start there, then what? Well, you know, again, you can think in in the infinite eternal ellipse. You know, the infinite's up there in the static level domain in level 1. Okay. And we talked about how there's 2 things there. You know, the infinite's not alone in level 1. The universal one of infinity is also there. You know, cohabitating that domain with the infinite. So. And we've spent a lot of time thinking of trying to understand what the heck this universal one of infinity thing is, you know. And we've discovered that it's the original, and it has 2 sides. It has the first center side, and the paradise trinity side. You know, and we've even kind of imagined it. We could think about it as, you know, like a big disc or something that has a flat surface on one side, and that's the Paradise Trinity, and a single peak on the other side, and that's the first center. Okay? But that's the original, you know, and we discovered a little bit ago, oh, yeah, the original has 2 sides. There's functionality that comes from both sides of the original. Okay, well, if I'm God the Infinite, and I want to, you know, express myself, I grab a hold of the original, and I express through it. Well, if I express through the first center side and you know, going that direction around through the first source, that is, you know, through the first center and through the infinite one, what am, you know, as God the infinite, what kind of an expression am I making? What do we call that expression of God the infinite? We call that God the Father. That expression of God the infinite that goes through the first center and through the infinite one, you know, the next step is the universal Father. I mean, that's the God the infinite expressing himself as God the Father. Or in other words, God the Father is the expression of God the infinite through the first center and the infinite one. Ah, but there's another side to the original. What if the God the infinite says, well, I want to express the other way too. This is conforms with possibility. I have two sides, two potential ways to express myself. What if I express myself through the Paradise Trinity and through the infinite capacity? Now what do we call that expression of God the infinite? God the Mother.
But now, okay. The Trinity that you mentioned there, mm-hmm. is made up of
Father, no, and Spirit. No, it's not. That's the first triunity.
Oh, okay.
The Paradise Trinity is a fourth fact.
Oh.
You know, and from this deity viewpoint, it's original. It's first, and Father, Son, and Spirit, and Mother are second. You know, like we've talked about this, if you want to just think about the three absolute persons in relation to the Trinity, when you're doing a top-down view, think about you've got it all balled together in an I am-like way, and you go, well, there's some of this stuff that I can pull out of there. It doesn't have to all stay stuck together. I can pull out this part, and I can call it the Universal Father, and I can pull out this part, and I can call it the Eternal Son, and I can pull out this part, and I can call it the Infinite Spirit, and that's all I can pull out. All I can, you know, what's his pulling out, all that I can personalize out of that? There's three personalities that can be drawn out. You can, you know, that personality grasps can grab two things, or three things, and pull them out of that. And then there's a part that personality can't grasp. It's non-personalizable. The part that's left behind, that's the Paradise Trinity. Okay? Yeah. See, so in that top-down view, you have the Paradise Trinity first. See, and you also have, see, technically, like I said, I mean, when you start talking about the Universal Father, you're really technically speaking about an absolute fact, okay? But the roots behind that, you know, are infinite. There's the infinite one, see? Okay? Just like the immediate roots back behind the God the Mother, are things like the infinite capacity. See, things. See, so what you're starting to get the picture of is you can think about how, you know, that, you know, yeah, I mean, we always talk about the first source and center as being part of God the Father, and it is. But in the full sense of when you're just sort of thinking about the full infinite picture, but the infinite one is obviously an infinite fact, and the Father absolute is not an infinite fact. That's the Father as absolute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if the Trinity is this non-personalizable mm-hmm. other substance or the rest of it,
mm-hmm.
then you're taking out of that non-personalizable another personalizable, which is God the Mother.
No, there's more than that involved. When you're drawing that out, I mean, see, even when you're going this way, as you pass through the infinite one,
yeah.
to get to the Universal Father, you passed by another thing. What cohabitates the second level domain with the infinite one? The deity absolute. Okay. The reservoir that you're going to draw deity out of. Okay? So that you can think of God the Father. See, has his roots in the first center in the infinite one, but the deity is being pulled out of the deity absolute. Okay, it's the same way here. I mean, you have this relationship to these two aspects of deity, the Paradise Trinity and the infinite capacity. But remember, we talked about that was the whole point of going through this really complicated primary and secondary causation thing. Is, you know, they were talking about the deity absolute is, you know, you have to make deity, so you have to draw it out of the deity reservoir. Okay, so that's, you know, so in this picture, you've got these three contiguous levels here, and there's a flow that's being drawn out of them. The deity absolute and the Paradise Trinity and the infinite capacity give rise to God the Mother.
But they're still not personal.
No, once it's, I mean, once you have the Mother and the Father.
No,
I'm not there yet. Once you have just the deity, the Mother and the Father, yeah, then you personalize that as God the Father and God the Mother.
Didn't the Mother come from, you said the Mother came from the Trinity, which is a non-personal reality.
Non-personalizable.
Non-personalizable.
But the deity, the stuff from the deity absolute and the stuff from the infinite capacity is personalizable. For instance, the architects of the master universe are persons, you know, and their deity substance is the absolute capacity.
Well, super
I just
person.
Want to know where the personalizable aspect.
Yeah,
is.
Right. So it's coming from the other things, you know.
Just
in the same way that the personalizable part of God the Father is not coming from the first center. That's just his root point.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's not coming from the Paradise Trinity root point either.
Okay,
that's just their root points. What's personalizable really is what is built upon that root. You know, as soon as you go 1 nanometer away from that plane that is the Paradise Trinity, now it's personalizable. Okay. So that was a big aside, but that's what opens up here. It's another avenue. Instead of starting with the I Am. And that it immediately gives you the Father and the Mother, see, in this picture, because there's two sides of the original, and God the Infinite is going to express down as God the Father and God the Mother. Okay.
To advocate the omnipotence of primal deity would be equal to disenfranchising well nigh 1 million creator sons of paradise, not to mention the innumerable hosts of various other orders of concurring creative assistance. There is but one uncaused cause in the whole universe. All other causes are derivatives of this one first great source and center. And none of this philosophy does any violence to the free willness of the myriads of the children of deity scattered through a vast universe. Within a local frame, volition may appear to function as an uncaused cause, but it unfailingly exhibits inheritance factors which establish relationships with the unique, original, and absolute first causes. All volition is relative. In the originating sense, only the Father I Am possesses finality of volition. In the absolute sense, only the Father, the Son, and the Spirit exhibit the prerogatives of volition unconditioned by time and unlimited by space. Mortal man is endowed with free will, the power of choice. And though such choosing is not absolute, nevertheless, it is relatively final on the finite level and concerning the destiny of the choosing personality.
Okay, just one little thing to notice in there. See how they're alluding to what I was just saying. See, they're making use of this now. That all volition is relative. And that sentence was probably a lot more restricted than you thought. Look at how they start out about one of those relativities. It's like, well, relative to the originating sense, okay, and then relative to the absolute sense, okay, I mean, you know, relative can be a really big word. It doesn't have to just be way down in the finite. You know, when you talk about really going, see, above the level where you have the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, and the aisle, you know,
You know, you back up above that, and you know, you actually start to struggle for names for things. You know, there's some use to thinking about a name like God the Infinite. There's some use to a name like the Father Infinite. There's some use for a name like the Father I Am. It all depends on kind of what you're kind of focusing on, what you're sort of following back to its roots. When you say Father I Am, that's when you're, you know, you're there at the level where you have the Son in the aisle, there with the Father. If you go back before there was a differentiation between aisle likeness and eternal Son likeness, you know, in other words, if you put spirit and energy back together, you see, and when you do that, as soon, if you go back before that, you don't really have a Father technically, because you don't have a Son. You know, you also don't have a universal controller because you don't have an aisle. But you know, if you're saying, well, you know, if I bring that back and sort of follow the what happens, you know, through the Father route backwards, you know, it's like, well, I'm heading from the Father back into the I Am. Well, let's call that the Father I Am. Or if you're wanting to think more of, well, I don't want to go all the way back to the I Am. If I, let me just think about going back to the infinite. Well, I call that the Father Infinite. You know, so in other words, you're going back from the third level to the second level back up to the first level. You're sort of following the Father track all the way to its roots. But there's other tracks, you know, and so there's other ways you could talk about, you know, like we, you know, we talked about the infinite I Am and the infinite All Are. That was two ways we gave names to following the tracks, you know, back in different ways. Okay, so, but see, in the absolute sense, you know, so that's where you're really dropping down. I mean, you're not going to relate to the Father as infinite. You can begin to contemplate that. But, you know, when you go back to the absolutes, the spirit absolute, and the mind absolute, and the matter absolute, and the volition absolute. And, you know, you go back to absolutes. You don't go back to infinites, you know, in terms of any experience. Your personality doesn't have an infinite dimension. It has three finite, three absonite, and an absolute dimension. You know, so your that absolute dimension of your personality can take you back to those absolute anchors. But beyond that, you know, you need to call in your adjuster to help you to sort of, you know, can you get an even bigger picture than that? And start thinking about things like God the Infinite or whatnot.
If we go back to the beginning of this paper.
Yeah.
When they start, in the beginning of their discussion, they start to mention omnipotence.
Mm-hmm.
Embraces the power potential of the Almighty Supreme, and the Supreme Being. Well, I was puzzled by that.
It's oh, the back to the beginning of the section, you mean? Here.
Yeah, the section. Yeah. It's like, I think of this Supreme as being, well, it's certainly sub-infinite, sub-absolute.
Right, I mean,
it seems like they're starting too low down.
Well, no, they're penetrating all the way down what they're doing. I mean, you can talk about omnipotence at the highest level. Okay, and then we can talk about pushing that down. You can talk about the kind of omnipotence that you have in God, the ultimate. And, you know, immediately as you're downstepping that power nature, before you pass down into the finite, you pass through the power that's embedded in the Supreme Being. Now you keep penetrating down, you know, below the Supreme Being, down into the finite. Okay, now that powerness that you've been following down is now the Almighty Supreme. That's all they're saying, is that I'm trying to think what else. I mean, the reason that they did that is they're really trying to set up this, you know, this the extent of the picture.
Yeah.
You know. Uh-huh. Okay. I mean, you got this, the Almighty Supreme, and right now you're thinking that's a pretty huge thing to think about, you know. But you know, you can go all the way up to God of the Infinite here. Okay. And the thing to do it is instead of thinking so vertically, think about it all together as one, like we tend to do around the ellipse. Okay, you go around the ellipse, and
You know, and there's infinite and absolute and, you know, and supreme and ultimate and sevenfold and Son and Spirit. And, you know, it's all there all together.
Well, it's a stretch to think that two things can both be omnipotent.
Not, I mean,
as your logic tells you.
Just recognizing it is hierarchical. I mean, anything above you is omnipotent of you, but anything above it is omnipotent of it and of you. And anything above it is omnipotent. It just goes on and on, and on, all the way up to God the Infinite.
This sentence, there is but one uncaused cause in the whole universe. And when they say cause, ties into the logical causation, so it's a thing that you can think through. And I've noticed a lot of people have a problem with not believing in God because how could this be that something does not have a cause?
Right.
But when you think about it, it really is a logical process here because a finite being such as us, it's logical that we can't comprehend an infinite being and his, antecedents. He doesn't have it. But then also, it's further more reasonable in that it's not a mind thing or a logical or a reason thing that you get to God. That's the faith reach.
Well, I mean, technically, see, it's not rational. You're not getting there merely by reason. But it is logical. You know, see, I've been trying to tease that, you know. You know, your logical acumen is just like your faith. It can jump all the way and grab a hold of the root. Okay, and then, you know, you can use your reason to fill in what's in between your faith grasp and where you are, for instance. Same way with your logical acumen. Especially with the help of the adjuster. You can reach all the way up, grab a hold of God the Infinite, you know, because you can recognize the logical position that holds in a picture that you can form in your mind. You can grab a hold of that, and now you can start to fill in the blanks. Well, it's a lot of blanks. It's an infinite number of blanks, but you can start filling them in. Okay, your logical acumen allows you to do that. I'm not exercising my faith, especially if I go all the way to God the Infinite, because like I said, I mean, we can only, with our personality, and hence our faith, we can only penetrate to the absolute level. I mean, I'm contemplating back behind that. you know, this is not a personal recognition of God the Absolute. It's a logical recognition of God the Absolute.
Oh,
see?
And that goes beyond person.
Right. See, because I'm actually going back behind personality, even.
Whereas our faith only goes to a person, true faith.
Yeah. I mean, you think about, you know, if you're going around the ellipse, okay, in level three, you've got the Universal Father and the Eternal Son. Okay, and if I go back past them, well, I think I've gone back past the personality absolute and the volition absolute. Okay, well, at least I have the reservoir of all personality, you know, the infinite one. You know, and that's that's only level two. I can go back to, I've gone completely pre-will. Okay, see, you're taking it way back. You're not using personal recognition at all. You're reaching with your logical acumen that allows you to grab a hold of the infinite eternal ellipse and see the logic of that picture.
So the mind is behind the logical acumen.
No. I'm understanding with my mind,
okay.
You know, but the logical acumen's in the Holy Spirit.
Oh.
Okay, and how did it get in the Holy Spirit? Well, it got there from the Creative Mother Spirit. Well, how did it get in the Creative Mother Spirit? It got there from the Trinity.
Okay.
Oh, well, I'm all the way back up at level one,
yeah.
When I get to the Trinity. See, so that, look at there. That's another route. Instead of trying to go the personality route, I could go this way. I have a route to the, up to the, you know, around to the
Paradise Trinity side. See, that's what the incredible thing is about this, having this other column, the mother column, recognizing the mother. It's this other way of getting a hold of the picture that goes beyond what personality gives you. You know, and that's why I said, especially think about how the adjuster can help in this regard, because when I go up this route, I get to the infinite upholder, and the adjuster is a fragment of that. Well, that ought to be able to really help me to expand the way that I can grasp a hold of reality besides mere faith grasp. Well, they're just trying to get you to do what we've been doing here, to try to think about, instead of putting God all together into one ball, you know, break God up into the facets, into the parts, you know, and start recognizing that not everything is all, for instance, balled up into faith. Mm-hmm. You know, there's more to reality than just that. And it's just as cool. right? Okay, let's keep going here so we don't take forever here. Let's see, where in heck were we? right here. Wait, I'm lost. Hold on. No.
Paragraph 1300.
Is that where we are? Oh, okay.
To advocate
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. So we went so far astray, I couldn't even find my way back. Let's remember what that last sentence was before. Okay, so mortal man is endowed with free will, the power of choice, and through such though such choosing is not absolute, nevertheless, it is relatively final on the finite level and concerning the destiny of the choosing personality. Okay. Now let's roll.
So our destiny is as an ascendant being. We can choose it.
Right.
We can't choose
it. You'll see we're going to talk about that. Yeah. We're going to go back.
Volition on any level short of the absolute encounters limitations, which are constitutive in the very personality exercising the power of choice. Man cannot choose beyond the range of that which is choosable. He cannot, for instance, choose to be other than a human being, except that he can elect to become more than a man. He can choose to embark upon the voyage of universe ascension. But this is because the human choice and the divine will happen to be coincident upon this point. And what a son desires and the father wills will certainly come to pass.
Okay. So, choose beyond the range of that which is choosable. There's a composability coming in. Okay, what do they mean? He cannot, for instance, choose to be other than a human being. Mm-hmm. What is a human being? That's that upward moving phenomenon. Okay, they're contrasting human being with man. Okay, not male, okay, but man. What's the difference between the two? Okay, man is just the fact. Okay, human is the upward arrow. Okay, and like we were saying, you are the upward arrow, and you can't choose to be the creator, the downward arrow. You're the upward arrow, period. You always will be. But you can choose to actually move up, to take the fact point from the bottom level and start moving the fact point up. But why? I choose to ascend. It's like, no, of course not. Like they're saying, the only reason that you have that choice is because the Father has chosen to make that a possibility. The Father has chosen to make a doorway in the top. Okay? You can spend forever going around like this, and that little circular thing, will just become part of the Almighty. Or you can choose to open to go through the door that the Father chose to open.
Is that the adjuster?
No, it's the Holy Spirit.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the only reason that you can send a spirit of truth or a thought adjuster is because there's a place for them to come to, and a doorway to get to you. The Holy Spirit's first. When Jesus introduces the kingdom, the notion of the kingdom of heaven, you know, the first thing he directly ties to what he means by that is the Holy Spirit. You know, go back and look at that when he introduces the kingdom of heaven concept. He doesn't talk about the Spirit of Truth. He doesn't talk about thought adjusters or, you know, or the cosmos or any, you know, anything that you might attach to that phrase. He talks about the Holy Spirit because that's step one. Wow. Okay, there has to be a place first. Okay. All right. So let's see. So let's see what else we have there.
Chris,
yeah.
You're bringing up something that's that's always been a mystery to me, which is why didn't Jesus talk about the cosmos? Mm. These people weren't stupid. They lived in a time with dark night skies. Right. They could see the Milky Way.
Right.
They could see the procession of the constellations. And I have often thought, you know, you're talking about the fact that everything is logical and that there's no magic. In so many ways, it seems to me that the way Jesus presented everything must have sounded magical to them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, especially where they were, you know. They basically interpreted everything he said magically, and that's what we, you know, what we have. One of the, not to belabor this, but one of the key things that's in play there is finally revealed to us here. Remember when you go back and read the Planetary Mortal Epics, they tell you an amazing thing, a mind-boggling thing about the normal order. You know, that literally you get to, you're getting these epical dispensations. A planetary prince comes. And does he tell you all about, you know, paradise and all this? No, he doesn't even tell you about the constellation. He only reveals up to the system level. Okay, and then you know, hundreds of thousands of years roll by, no one mentions anything except up to the system level. Okay, finally, an Adam and Eve show up. Yeah, fine. Okay, now we're gonna, they're gonna tell us more. No, they reveal up to the constellation level, and tens of thousands of years roll by. I mean, this goes on for hundreds of thousands of years. You know, where it normally takes a very, very long time before they even tell you about Havona. This is the normal order of things. It is mind-numbingly methodical and plotting from our perspective. You know, and we have that. You see, it doesn't give consternation to the rest of the world like it does to us, because we have been given an awareness ahead of our time of things. You know, that liberty notion that entered in with Lucifer. This is problematic because it introduces a tension in us that is not normally there in normal worlds. They're completely content for hundreds of thousands of years with what's revealed to them, which from, you know, the perspective we're reading right now is like, you got to be kidding me, okay? You're not even going to tell me about Michael? You're not even going to tell me about the local universe for hundreds of thousands of years? Okay? But that's the normal order. It's very plotting.
You know, it makes you feel like you're different than everybody else, kind of, when you read this book.
Ding, 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 ding.
I wish that I never found
it. Yeah, be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, because ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, good luck on reading that.
Yeah, and just like toothpaste, doesn't go back in the tube. You just got to go forward, you know. But that's what the revelation is here. It's just to get all the toothpaste out of all the tubes, and people have no choice, you know, get it out of that, you know, all these closed loops. It is time to be about the Father's business. I mean, you got to, you know, get out of these comfort zones. You got to, you know, it's like, I don't want to. Well, you have to.
So if we had not had these defaults, in the ordinary course of things, we would be at about a point in time where we would know about constellation?
Well, we would have, you know, let's just say we'd gotten a magisterial son, you know, so we'd been revealed up to the local universe level. But, you know, think about, remember when Machaventa came? You know, he's still in the Adamic dispensation. So that's why, you know, he said, you know, he was who he was. He invoked the Most Highs. He's fitting in right with the Adamic dispensation and only revealing up to the constellation level. Right. Priest of the Most High. And again, not to belabor the point so we can finish up, but just remember, you know, the issue in play with the Lucifer Rebellion, which we're still stuck in. You know, these closed loops of self, they're not sophistry proof. See, that's the problem. Doesn't matter how fancy it is, it's not sophistry proof. We must be. Okay, we've got to break out of this mode where we're prone to sophistry, because it's getting to the point where it could cause some really, really serious problems. Secularist totalitarianism, you know, the sophistry is inherent in that, and where that leads civilization is where we cannot go. Now, it's not where we shouldn't go. We cannot go there. Okay, and they will not let us go there. And if they have to get out bigger prods, you know, they will. You know, we will not go there. Okay, this is the first gentle step. Okay, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. You know, guys, wake up, because you are not going to evaporate civilization. It is the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. They will not allow that to happen. But you're moving into a mode where you could do some serious damage. Okay, to the key threads of civilization. And so either you start picking up the ball now, recognizing the personal responsibility and the self-control, or we're going to make you recognize your personal responsibility and self-control.
The blanket goes away and, you know, out comes the sword.
The trumpets will blow. okay, let's keep going here.
John wanted to say, had a question.
Well, I was just going to say that the choice we have is to become, like it says here, to choose to be other than... We can become more than a man. In other words, right. We can grow more in this direction is the way I look at it.
Right.
But these other forces can cause us, the rebellious forces, can cause us to be less than a man and go or just disintegrate that human.
Well, you know, what's the fundamental? Humanism is part of the fundamental. You know,
right,
it's saying, no, the man is everything. The man goes from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Man is infinity.
Yeah.
No.
In the mortal life, paths of differential conduct are continually opening and closing. And during the times when choice is possible, the human personality is constantly deciding between these many courses of action. Temporal volition is linked to time, and it must await the passing of time to find opportunity for expression. Spiritual volition has begun to taste liberation from the fetters of time, having achieved partial escape from time sequence. And that is because spiritual volition is self-identifying with the will of God.
Okay. Just notice how they're speaking very matter of course in an understanding that we've tried to develop. Notice how that it starts out... during the times when choice is possible, the human personality is constantly deciding between these many courses of action. Okay, choice, decision, action. Okay, they're putting all three together there, the full picture: choice down into decision and out into action. Okay? Spirit, mind, matter. Okay, and that's what they mean by, you know, they wanted a pithy expression for that whole sequence there: temporal volition. Temporal volition is linked to time, i.e., you know, when you take it all the way down, choice, decision, action, it's obviously linked to time, the motion that you're syncing up with the motion of everything. But see, spiritual volition, you know, we've talked about it. I mean, just the choice itself. Don't take it, you know, don't connect it to decision, even to action. Just the choice itself is up there in the spirit domain. Okay. And, you know, it's just spiritual volition, just that choice. Like we said, I mean, that pure spiritual conscious domain has no notion of time. And therein lies its biggest problem. it can imagine all kinds of things when it doesn't have to consider time. The idealism goes to infinity and and eternity, and see, your pure spiritual consciousness doesn't have any notion of time. So as soon as you develop some idealism, as soon as you awaken your idealism, which fundamentally is timeless in consciousness, you start to get frustrated, because no matter how much you try to imagine there isn't time and space, there is. Okay, and frustration begins. Spiritual consciousness is the awakening of frustration. Okay, that's the tension. Remember we've talked about the bifurcation, the tension you create. Well, if you're just one endpoint, there's no tension. But as soon as you actually grab a hold of the other endpoint, you don't just grab a hold of the endpoint. Guess what? You grab a hold of the tension between the two. Okay. You will experience all kinds of frustration that your idealistic consciousness just cannot be directly manifested. No matter how much you try, no matter how many people you get together to try to, use the power of numbers to make it happen, nothing works.
All right. See, that has no patience associated with it.
Right, it's impatient.
It's like getting angry. You're trying to force a situation in the here and now. Right. And when you're not being patient about it.
See, and this is
zeal can do the same thing.
The self has a material consciousness.
You don't have to be angry. You can just be zealous.
Right. The self has a material consciousness, and the self has a spiritual consciousness. Yeah. You're just down here. Mm-hmm. See, you got to recognize there's something. There's the resolution of the tension that twofold potential of self character has. You got to go up to resolve the tension. And the new foundation, that domain, what is it? Patience. We all know what that new foundation is. It's the doorway to the answer. Until you allow patience, there is no solution to the tension. The tension can only build. The more you get that new spiritual circuit flowing, and the more it's not like the material circuit that was already flowing just there innately by birth, the more tension you've got in there, the worse it gets. You've got to go up so that you can weave the two together.
So if the initial cattle prod is fear, and the second cattle prod is this tension and frustration.
It's the pain.
Yeah.
Of seeing the better way and being stuck in repeating this lesser flaw over and over.
But there still has to be that instigator to move.
Yeah. Right. See, you go from fear, anguish, dread, awe, reverence. You get all the way up. Okay, so fear is still there as a cattle prod, but now you have the contrast between reverence and fear. You've got that. You have that differential now. Yeah. Not satisfying you either. Yeah.
So, Chris, reconciling the adjustment of ideals to facts is the function of wisdom.
Right. That level of patience, that's level of, it's the gateway. The spirit of wisdom is the gateway. All right.
Volition, the act of choosing, must function within the universe frame, which is actualized in response to higher and prior choosing. The entire range of human will is strictly finite limited, except in one particular. When man chooses to find God and to be like him, such a choice is super finite. Only eternity can disclose whether this choice is also super absinite. Hmm. To recognize deity omnipotence is to enjoy security in your experience of cosmic citizenship, to possess assurance of safety in the long journey to paradise. But to accept the fallacy of omniscience is to embrace the colossal error of pantheism.
Okay, couple all doingness. I'm getting one step at a time. It's probably likely I'm going to explain the paragraph. okay, so you have two things there. One, a very personal point at that first sentence. What did they set up? you know, in the compossibility section, you know, this clear recognition that you have deity reaching down and you going up. It's not just you going up into places unknown. Mm-hmm. That sounds lonely and no, you know, before you go up, the place has been prepared for you. Okay? Before you go up to the mansion worlds, guess what? A mansion has been prepared for you there. God has come, you know, has reached down first. Okay? That's what they're getting at here. This the fact that all powerfulness is coming down. That's why you can fear not. If you're actually an upward moving phenomenon, not only are you moving away from the zeroth level of fear, but you're moving into greater and greater omnipotence, immersed in it. More and more, what is around you is under control the farther you go up. So the more you can see yourself as something that's moving into more control and away from fear, the more you can fear not. Okay. But if all you're doing is just trying to move away from fear into a vast, infinite capacity, that sounds kind of scary too. You know, now you're moving away from one fear towards another fear, and it's not, you know, this enjoy the security. That's what they're talking about. The assurance of safety. And then that last little thing is an interesting little, just kind of a philosophical little side that they threw in there. Pantheism. Normally you don't see that capitalized like that. Okay. Why did they capitalize it? Because there's two things that you mean by pantheism. One is sort of the historical thing, which you would always just make lowercase p, some vast menagerie of lowercase g gods, you know, some pantheistic, you know, hodgepodge of gods. Okay, that's lowercase p pantheism. They purposely capitalize it here, which is even not normally done to distinguish, but they purposely did it here because there's a philosophical pantheism. Okay, and the notion there is that the forces and manifestations and whatnot of the self-existent universe is God.
That's Lucifer.
No. Well, yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, kind of, sort of, but just it's not really Lucifer. Pantheism is where you're just letting the doingness or the emanations coming from the universe as being God.
Like all the evil things that are happening, you're thinking that that's okay. Well, there's
no, there is no evil.
No, I mean hurricanes. That's all doing. Let's say that would be the colossal era of God doing.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in that sense, yeah. But don't call that evil, though. I mean,
no,
yeah, right. But bad, quote unquote bad things. The difficult things that happen, right? But even without thinking about the difficult things and trying to rationalize that into the picture, okay, just that notion that that you're going to take all of that, you know, sort of like the may the force be with you, sort of notion. And you're going to deify that. Capital D, deity, deify it. So capital P, see, that's why they did that. We now have a mode of expression that actually allows you to distinguish between those two definitions of pantheism. Capitalized one to indicate that's where you're talking about, see, not recognizing capital D deity, like the first sentence says, and just letting what you see be that capital D deity, okay? You know, and that's, you know, it's, I mean, talk about a universal error. I mean, you know, you've literally embraced everything that you can see or imagine and wrapped it all in error. So it's a colossal error, okay? you know, that sort of there's just this all doingness, you know, and that's God. No. That's what they're getting at there.
Was I on the right track?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, because the moment that you say there's an all doingness and that's God, well, then the first thing that you think of is, well, what about the hurricane? What about the tsunami? What about the, you know, what about the earthquake? And, you know, and then your whole theology gets really complicated to try to rationalize all that. And
isn't it nice that we call it an act of God, even?
Yeah, and
when the tree falls on your house.
And the other option is if you you're not going to bring in an act of God, you know, in a true pantheism, you're either going to try to create some sort of a complicated rationalization scheme why your life still has meaning in the midst of all these bad things and whatnot. You know, and you're not going to say that God works in mysterious ways because you don't have a God. You're going to come up with some sort of other kind of rationalization scheme. Or you probably, you know, most people aren't smart enough to do that, so probably you're just going to take the simple way. I mean, I don't know how I'd do it. So I'd probably just take the simple way, nihilism. Okay, now you're getting to Lucifer. Okay? I mean, you know, if you just let, you know, a self-existent universe and its doingness be God, you know, well, you know, then I'm just a momentary doing this and that, and there's nothing really to, no purpose to my life, no significance to my life, you know.
So it starts with ignoring God, and eventually, right, if you do that long enough, right, it's easier to deny God.
Right, yeah.
It still goes back to that very first paragraph read tonight, omnipotence and compossibility. If you apply to God one quality, and you call it omnipotent, all possible, all power,
yeah,
and that's the only one he's got,
right,
then you have to go to a bunch of incorrect assumptions. But if you add to that all wisdom, as Michael brought up, and all kindness, and all generosity, and all love, then, you know, he is self-limiting all of those negative possibilities. They don't happen. They're everything is in balance, and that balance is the consistency of compossibility. It's all taken care of. If it's all just power, which is the first thought we have about God, which is a good thought, it's correct, but it's just real narrow.
Right. And how it ties into this very last thing. See, you know, how if you really do fixate on power, what you're ultimately going to drag your consciousness down to the power level, down to the material level, and all you're going to have is power, you know, and its machinations, you know, like earthquakes and stuff. That's a good point for bringing that up. See, it's another way of understanding why the heck are they mentioning pantheism? Where did that come from? See, it fits in, see, in this picture.
Well, it's a common notion among a lot of Christians. For a lot of people that aren't Christians, the end of the world. The end of the world has a firm grip on a lot of people's minds. That it's,
all you have to do is mention it, and everyone perks up.
And
ooh, I want to hear about that. What do you think about that?
Just like that. Your radio show.
Yeah. You got some?
Well, I'm a Christian, and most Christians that I know don't really believe in the end of the world. They believe in the New Jerusalem coming here to Earth.
Right. If you, it all depends on what you focus on in the Book of Revelation. The dark Gothic stuff, or the part that the revelators even use. You know, they coin two words. That passage in Revelation that says the new heaven, the new earth, and the new Jerusalem. Well, they gave us a new name for the earth, the name of truth, Urantia, your heavenly place. And they coined two words for the other two things there. The new Jerusalem, what's that word?
Jerusalem.
The new heaven, what's that word?
Havona.
Right. That, you know, not only is that a good thing for those Christians who really just, you know, draw upon that, the relators are, you know, are stepping in, chiming in and saying, yeah. Good starting point. Let's build on that. So, you know, it all depends on how much fear you bring in, whether or not you bring in a lot of...
When you croak, isn't that the end of your world?
All right, see, if you take a very nihilistic viewpoint, like a pantheistic viewpoint, then that's what you've got. When you croak, it's the end. Pantheism is just, you know, it's one of two things. It's either just the simple notion of, you know, a multitude of anthropomorphic gods, or it's what we're talking about here.
Like the Greeks, they had...
Yeah, but that's not this.
That's a different pantheon.
That's the multitude of anthropomorphic gods. That's one pantheism. That would be pantheism with a small p. Oh. This is pantheism with a capital P. Okay. It's the other kind.
What does that explain for a capital P?
Well, this is what we've been talking about. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That definition. Okay. We got to wrap up pretty quick here, guys.
Pantheism isn't capitalized in my book.
Whoops.
Wow. Wow, you're stuck with the Greek gods then.
It's Olympus for you.
whoever put it together probably thought, well, that can't be right. Yeah. I'm going to lowercase that. Somebody made an error.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, I think a number of people have started thinking since I've started pointing out the importance of the capitalization stuff. These details are important, sometimes really, really important. You change the capitalization and you change the whole understanding, and all you have is misunderstanding. You have more distortion of meaning. Some of them are extremely important. I mean, this is kind of a minor point, but all right. Let's wrap her up here.
Tuesday night study group, we obsessed for quite a little while on spiritual tension.
Mm-hmm.
And you just talked about that.
Yep.
And it's on page 2006, at the end of the first full paragraph, when it's talking about what Jesus was feeling when he was on the cross. That superimposed upon all of this was his extreme mental anguish, his acute spiritual tension,
mm-hmm.
and a terrible feeling of human loneliness.
Yeah.
And yeah. Mo asked, what does spiritual tension mean? And you just explained it beautifully.
Right. That's what it is.
Because we couldn't figure it out. Too
right. And all right, now you know what it is. And I think you could even, when I was kind of visual about describing it, you could, oh yeah, I know that, I feel that. You know, it's this tension. It's literally because there's matter and there's spirit, and they're not the same, and there's a tension between them. You know, if you don't want that tension, either go up where resolution is possible or go down. Let go of spirit, and all the tension melts away. Well, if you let go of matter, you float away. It's bye-bye you.
Is that why Jesus said if you would save your life, you would lose it? Or no, if you would lose your life?
It's that, yes.
I forget how it's said.
Right, but it's correct. It is that.
If you want to save your life, you need to lose it.
This self needs to die. The self that just chases its tail and has tension at best. That self needs to die.
But don't just kill it in a vacuum. You got to be drawn first by, you got to, by.
Go up.
Yeah, yeah.
Harmonize that self.
And then you'll see it objectively, and then you can say, yeah, I don't need it.
All right. So next time we'll, this is a pretty fun section, this next one. We touched upon this and it got really tense in the room. There was a spiritual tension in the room when this came up a few weeks back. We'll get back to that and see. Hopefully we can clean up some of those loose ends that might still be there about the whole notion of predestination and free will. Let's take a moment here.